3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present, of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m. Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're on the Monday Breakfast Show with me, Hannah, and Rob. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing so good. I'm standing up this morning.
You are standing up. It's a little bit unsettling.
Is it disconcerting?
You're like, I'm sorry. Staring down.
I'm going to sit down.
No, it's okay. You can stand.
I don't know. If I sit down, I'm going to get sleepy.
Yeah.
But I'm doing good. How are you, Hannah?
I'm back from a month
in Peru.
I am.
Do you want to give listeners a quick highlights?
Okay. It was amazing. It was crazy. Yep. It was the craziest holiday I've ever had. It was like so action-packed. Every single day, activities, beautiful waterfalls, and sloths, and piranhas, and anacondas, and
damn,
like we went to the jungle, and we went to the Amazon rainforest, and it was amazing. And then we saw lots of llamas. Peru has so many different landscapes. It's insane. There's like beautiful, extremely high altitude, rocky mountains, and then stunning like rainforests with blue, beautiful water and waterfalls, and then the jungle with like, the jungle is like, yeah.
That intense. Sounds really beautiful.
It was really beautiful.
Was Peru part of Gondwana? Do you know Gondwana, like the supercontinent that existed before?
I reckon, probably, surely.
Because
the landscapes.
Yeah, because I remember I have a friend in Boraloo, aka Perth, and they were saying that along that coast, they have some really amazing different landscapes. That's like technically, like different soils from like 7 different continents or something.
Yeah.
So they have all of this like really sandy soil, and then they have mountains, and then they have like rainforest, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's related to that.
Totally. Well, seeing all of the crazy rocks, I just wish that I was like a geology nerd, because it was so cool.
So many cool rocks.
In the mountains, when we were going, like heading to the rainforest. It was also 4,000 meters above sea level.
Wow.
It was like crazy. I got out of the car to have a little wee, and I felt like so, I kind of felt drunk or something. It was it was crazy.
Interesting.
But the rocks were like Star Wars. It was like space.
Something out of a different planet.
It was so cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, very good to have you back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Good to see you behind the panel again in your natural element.
I've missed the panel.
Maybe we'll just talk about what we have coming up in the show this morning. So we're going to start the show with a conversation with a friend of the show, Violet Coco, from the Defend Dissent Coalition and many other organizations that Violet is involved with. And yeah, we'll be speaking about the upcoming protest tomorrow to, yeah, protest to protect protest, which is very important as the Victorian government sort of continues its crackdown on dissent.
Yeah.
And then following that, we are also going to be speaking with Lauren Caulfield, who is the coordinator of the Beyond Survival Project out of Flat Out, and has also co-authored a report which looks at the damage caused by Victoria Police's responses to family violence. So very excited to speak with them about that at around 7:30. What's after that, Hannah?
And then after that, we're going to be speaking to Jess Morrison. She's going to be telling us about her campaign that she's running, calling for accountability in Australia's military trade.
That's going to be big.
Yeah.
And then following that, we will be speaking with Jay Coonan from the Anti-Poverty Centre about a report released by the Commonwealth Ombudsman last week, which exposed that almost 1,000 people had their welfare payments unlawfully cut between 2022 and 2024. Jay was on the Thursday Breakfast Show last week talking about the same report, but it is a very big report, so I'm excited to speak with them about to, yeah, give more information about the report. And we were going to end the show with an interview with Ali Bezaroglu, who is the Director of Legal Services at the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, about the bail reform laws that the Victorian government has proposed into Parliament 2 or 3 weeks ago in the middle of July. It's obviously the second time that the Victorian government has tried to toughen bail laws this year alone. But unfortunately, Ali is sick. So we'll see what else we have time for.
Yeah. Should we do the headlines?
Mm-hmm.
Some folks know about it, some don't. No. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 11th of August, 2025. UK police have arrested 466 people for their support of the recently banned Palestine Action Group in London on Saturday. The UK government used anti-terror legislation to ban the group back in July in a move condemned by groups such as the United Nations, Amnesty International, and Greenpeace. Alongside Australia, the UK is also complicit in Israel's genocide against the people of Palestine through providing funding, arms, and equipment to the Zionist entity known as Israel. Of course, the UK government was fundamental in helping the Zionist movement form the State of Israel and legitimize itself through support going back to the Balfour Declaration over 100 years ago. The protesters from the Palestine Action Group arrested could face a maximum of 14 years in prison. In a post on social media platform X, the Met Police said anyone who came to Parliament Square on Saturday and held a placard expressing support for the Palestinian Action Group was, quote, either arrested or in the process of being arrested, end quote. In June, members of the group broke into a Royal Air Force base and sprayed red paint into the engines of two Voyager aircraft, which, you know, sort of helped spark this attack against the group. On Friday, Israel's Security Cabinet approved a plan to seize control of Gaza City and the entirety of the Gaza Strip meaning the almost a million people in that area would once again be forcibly displaced. Over the weekend, Israeli attacks across the Gaza Strip continued, killing at least 52 Palestinians. The death toll from the Israeli-induced starvation since October 7th, 2023, has now reached 217, at least 217, including 100 children.
Also in news this week, rising temperatures are taking a serious toll on students' ability to learn. According to new research from RMIT's Konstantina Vasilikopoulou and University of New South Wales Professor Matt Santamoris, the study analysed data from 1.5 million students across 61 countries and found that long-term exposure to heat in school environments significantly reduces cognitive performance. Complex subjects like mathematics are the most affected, and the impact is far worse for students in low-income and vulnerable communities, amplifying existing educational inequalities. Professor Santamoris said, quote, "This research highlights a critical and under-recognized consequence of climate change," and quote, "Heat stress doesn't just impact physical health, it undermines educational equity and affects humans' potential," end quote. The study warns that without effective intervention, student performance in some regions could decline up to 10% by 2050. It also links classroom heat exposure to increased mental health risks, suggesting a broader threat to students' overall well-being. While adaptation measures such as air conditioning, ventilation improvements, and urban cooling technologies can significantly reduce heat-related learning losses, the access to these remains deeply unequal. Professor Santamoris said, quote, "Cooling technologies must be made accessible to all students, not just those in affluent areas," end quote. The authors of this research are calling for urgent policy action to incorporate heat resilience into school infrastructure, emphasizing that protecting students from climate-driven heat is not only an environmental imperative, but a matter of educational and social justice. These have been the headlines for Monday, the 11th of August. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now. Step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR on 855 AM. Now we're going to be joined by a friend of the show, Violet Coco, and she's going to be telling us about the upcoming rally happening tomorrow on Tuesday, fighting for protesters' rights. We're joined by Violet, a frequent guest of 3CR and the Monday Breakfast Show. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's real fun to be back.
Good to have you. Do you want to start by telling me about the upcoming rally happening on Tuesday?
Yeah, thanks so much. I am a part of this amazing coalition, which is from one of the broadest spectrums of activists, of progressive movements that you could imagine. And basically, they've all united because the government is coming after our right to protest. And they're trying to introduce these laws and this legislation that will basically increase search powers for police at protest. They will limit where we can protest, basically ruling out the entire city, and they will limit what we can protest with. So things like lock-on devices or masks for COVID safety will be ruled out at protest. So it's a very serious attack on our democratic right to protest, and basically has all these other implications, which we'll come to in a minute. But the rally itself, just straight off the bat, is going to be 5:30 p.m., at Parliament House on Tuesday the 12th, and we have an amazing lineup of speakers and even some dance music, like some amazing artists. And the reason that we want to be there at that time and making lots of noise with these speakers and these artists is because they're actually going to be sitting at that time. And I just love protesting when the people that you're protesting about can actually hear you. Yeah. So we're going to make as much noise as possible. And so, yeah, please come along. Everybody come along. Bring your singing voices, your dancing shoes, and get ready to be heard by the people who are absolutely failing us right now. So it's going to be a really important time. Defend Dissent Coalition Instagram to check out more details. And it will be live streamed on that Instagram as well if you can't make it.
That sounds amazing. Why is it so important to fight for protesting rights?
That's a really good question. We, you know, have never had progressive change happen anywhere in the globe without the people taking to the streets and protesting about it, using things like marching and direct action to gain attention and to hold power. It's pretty clear that, you know, the government really, they only listen to the squeaky wheel, and so we have to be the squeakiest wheel. Mm-hmm. Obviously, also are beholden to many corporate investors. And so unless we are applying power and pressure and making a story, then they really don't tend to pay much attention to what the people actually want. I think, you know, it's times like these where there's so many invested lobbying groups trying to silence protest, whether it's about climate or whether it's about the military-industrial complex and stopping the genocide in Palestine. There's so many vested interests trying to influence our government to not act. And so it's obviously a time when they want to silence protest. And by protecting protest and defending our capacity to dissent, what you're really saying is that you want to allow the people to engage in democracy in between the 3 to 4 years in which we vote, because that's how we do that. That's how we've always done that. Protecting protest and protest is so important is because that's how we achieve change. That's how we gain the right to vote as women. That's how we ended a segregation of pools for First Nations people on this continent that came around through the freedom rides that happened here, and all these other amazing rights that we've won throughout history have all come from protest. And so it's very, very important for justice that we protect it.
Totally. What are the specific laws that are threatening people's rights to protest?
Yeah, so they want to basically limit what we can protest with. So they want to limit the fact that we can protest with a mask, which is on one hand about COVID safety, but obviously it's also about protecting the identity of vulnerable people from both the surveillance state and from fascists and other people who, you know, have ill intent for those who are seeking justice. They also want to prevent us from having lock-on devices, which are ways in which protesters hold space peacefully against the violence of the state. They also want to limit certain symbols, and they call them terrorist symbols. But as you know, Palestine Action has just been labelled a terrorist organisation in the UK. And we also have instances where police have used these, you know, you're carrying a symbol that we don't understand, and it's just been, you know, the flag of a very innocent nation. But because they don't understand that symbol, they've used those powers to search and intimidate peaceful protesters. They also want to rule out being able to protest near a religious institution, which on the face of it might seem okay, but basically that would rule out the entire city for us to protest, because there's basically a church on every corner. So, yeah, it would be actually very detrimental to our capacity to protest in the city. And what is Melbourne City without protests? I couldn't imagine our city without marches running through them. And it also, all of this increases the police search powers in total as well, which is very, stressful, because the police are using these laws to intimidate protests. It basically is giving a green light for more police violence into the community, which is you know, we're already experiencing a militarized police. In Sydney last week, people were allowed to march over the Harbour Bridge. But here in Nam, when people peacefully tried to march over the King Street Bridge, they were met with this militarized police, these police with these massive shields and helmets and rubber bullets, and they were ready to engage almost at war. You know, it's militarized police. It's like a war against these peaceful protesters who just want to end a genocide and want to protect life. So these laws will only encourage more behaviour like that from the police, where they feel more emboldened to enact this violence against us. On the face of it, there's like these particular legislation, but it's also about this creeping authoritarianism and this capacity and green light for police to criminalise our democratic process.
What are the future impacts on local activism and activists that these new laws will have, apart from the ones that you've already listed?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the more that they criminalise protest, the more it kind of means that vulnerable people will shy away from engaging in democracy. Mm. And that's always a very sad time when we have people who might feel afraid, like trans people feeling afraid to march for their own rights, or First Nations people marching on the streets. They should feel safe doing that. And you know, there's always been a police presence that has instigated violence against protesters. But what these laws do is validate that more. And so what we would be seeing is that some people would feel more afraid to engage in democracy, and then we would also see a backfire effect, which is what's happened with the Defend Dissent Coalition, which is where the opposite has happened, and we've seen like the community uniting against these protests and actually a coalition being built, which makes us all stronger, because we're, you know, communicating and supporting each other across the different issues, which is, you know, I think very exciting, actually, and something very good to come out of this situation, which is, good.
Amazing. Before we wrap up, would you want to touch on what's happening with your friend Blake?
Yeah, so we had a protester for just over a month now be remanded into custody. And that means that he's sitting in a cell. It's just like a prison. They call it a remand centre, but it is just like a prison. And basically he's there because he picked up a chair and threw it at the ground while demanding the end to the weaponization of aid in Palestine. And what it's saying is that, you know, this government and the courts care more about the feelings of a chair than they do about the beautiful lives in Palestine. I would just be calling everybody here to please write a letter to Blake The details for his to do that is to is on the Defend Dissent Coalition Instagram and also the Activist Reinforcement Instagram. And basically, you know, I was sentenced to prison for 2 months last year for protesting, and I just know when you're in that hellhole, like getting letters is like a lifeline. It's protection, and it's like your social media. Like it's a line to the outside, and it's a reminder that you're in there because you care, and that you know you're not going to be forgotten, and that our community, you know, we say touch one, touch all. And so please, please, please write to Blake. Blake on 20, the details to write to him is on the Instagram, and come to our protest on the 12th to defend our rights and protect protest.
Thank you so much for coming onto the show today. You wrapped that up perfectly. Do you have any more call to actions to prevent this from happening, and remind listeners again on how people can get involved and the details of the rally on Tuesday?
Yes. So the Defend Dissent Coalition are also running a petition where we're basically, if we get enough signatures, we're making some protect protest legislation back at them. So we have a member of the Greens who is going to champion this legislation. If we get enough signatures on it, it has to be tabled. So come to the rally and sign that, or if you can't come to the rally and sign that, get in touch with us on our Instagram account and we'll send you a page and you can get your community to fill it out and write it. So again, that rally is at Parliament House at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday. Bring your dancing shoes and your loud voices, because we're going to make them listen.
Great. I'm so excited to see you there.
See you there.
We have a right to be in public space undertaking political activity. That is not something that people should be telling us that we can't do.
Multiple actions rolling over months and years and create huge sustained pressure of social change.
And what we're seeing around the country right now is increasing repression of protest.
Protest works. That's why I think we're seeing it criminalised all over the place.
3CR. Stay tuned, stay radical.
Down at the Metro Mine, down at the Metro Mine, who's gonna lie on that hard rail line? Stop everybody's coal digging grind. Coal mining takes your life away. It's a dead end job, I say. Get dust on your lung, get a cold blackened tongue, and a dead planet back with your pipe. Who's got a padlock and chain? Who's got a padlock and chain? Locking on tight to that coal train tonight. Tell me who's got a padlock and chain?
Yes, Wollongong people, do you dream? Yes, Wollongong people, do you dream? That sound up on the hill, yes, that's Peabody's drill. Cracking through your drinking river bed. Yes, Peabody's digging up that coal. Peabody's digging up that coal. Gonna lie it down on the track and make it pull all the coal back, cause nobody should be digging up coal.
That's right, tell me now. Who's got a padlock and chain? Who's got a padlock and chain?
Well, tell me now.
Hacking on tight to that coal train tonight. Tell me who's got a padlock and chain? Does it rain?
I'll name you the leader in crime. He's CEO of Peabody Mines. Mr. Gregory H. Boys, he's the leader of choice, for his greed will make him pay in time. We'll be standing in court one day. We'll be standing in court one day. We'll hear that judge's voice say, Mr. G.H. Boys, for your crimes you now must pay. Come on now.
Who's got a padlock and chain?
Come on now.
Who's got a padlock and chain?
Come on now.
Locking on
tight to that kill train tonight. Tell me who's got a bad luck and check.
There's a bright shorty on the banjo.
Except for the police show.
What's mine now?
Who's got a padlock and chain? Who's got a padlock and chain? Locking on tight to that kill train tonight. Tell me who's got a padlock and chain?
Talk to me, Weary.
Who's got a padlock and chain? Come on now, knocking on tight to that kill train tonight. Tell me who's got a padlock and chain?
That was Who's Got a Padlock and Chain by The Lurkers. And before that, we had Violet Coco telling us about tomorrow's rally, which will be at Parliament House at 5:30 p.m.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. On Thursday last week, Flat Out's Beyond Survival Project released a report revealing the widespread damage caused by Victoria Police's responses to family violence. The report does so through examining responses from 225 frontline workers and calls for the urgent need to move away from policing and increase investment in community-led family violence responses. The Monday Breakfast Show is now joined by Lauren Caulfield, who is the coordinator of the Beyond Survival Project and co-author of the report. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Thank you so much for joining us. Maybe you'd like to start by telling our listeners about the amazing and really important work that the Beyond Survival Project does.
Yeah, sure thing. So we're quite a small project, but we're focused on supporting people who are experiencing family violence, who's been harmed in the course of police responses or lack of response to that violence. And so we do that in a range of ways. We do individual legal support as well as wraparound family violence and social work assistance. And then we do a range of activities, including strategic advocacy, which is where this piece of work to gather evidence directly from practitioners and to sort of translate that back to the community comes in.
Yeah, wow. That sounds, it's so amazing that you're able to do that and so important as well. So let's move to talk about the report itself. Maybe you just want to run through what it found.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So this research is the first of its kind in that it gathers practice-based evidence from frontline workers about what they're actually seeing of family violence policing. So it's not what appears in police policy documents or press releases or those sorts of forms, but it's actually what practitioners are seeing on the ground. And we conducted this research because, as a small project, we see some really distinct themes in police harms. But because we run a small number of files, we have wanted to know whether these themes are echoed around the state. And of course, there are really significant challenges often in accessing that data. So it's notoriously difficult to get any data out of Victoria Police. Most of what is gathered via Freedom of Information requests, and those can take a year to 2 years to return. And then, of course, there are the challenges around smaller services who act to support survivors harmed by police responses often face capacity challenges and information sharing challenges. So it's really difficult to kind of get a measure on what are we looking at in practice in the context of a system where frequently police actually self-evaluate their responses to family violence. So we surveyed 225 frontline workers, And the results that we found very much mirror what we see in practice, and they are deeply concerning findings. They show harms to survivors that are absolutely patterned and they are widespread. They're not one-off incidents. They're story after story from practice that detail quite comprehensive harm. And notably in the findings, 90% of frontline workers said that they had witnessed police bias or discrimination. That includes racial targeting and racial profiling. It's a really significant stat. Many of them detailed witnessing that type of bias and discrimination on multiple occasions. 83% of people who contributed to the study said that they had witnessed police wrongfully and incorrectly identify the person experiencing the violence, the victim survivor, as the abuser or the perpetrator. And so that's what often gets called misidentification. It's frequently framed as a mistake, but has cascading consequences, of course, through the lives of survivors. So things like having child protection involved, facing criminal charges, often implications for housing, for employment. You know, it's a really significant area of harm. And then the third area that was very significant in the finding relates to police-perpetrated family violence itself. So in this study, more than half of the participants said that they had encountered situations where the person using violence was themselves the police officer, and many of those workers had encountered it on multiple occasions. So, of course, that is very significant because what it means is that the very agency who are tasked with responding to family violence or sort of located in the culture as being a site of safety actually have a really significant problem with abusers within their own ranks.
Wow, that's really scary. I was thinking about the 83% of responses, which in the report says that 83% of people in the report, say that police have misidentified the victim survivor, and that, you know, really speaks to the inherent bias that within the Victoria Police Force, right?
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely nailing it with that question, because I think it's something that's incredibly prevalent. It's really difficult to get data out of police about, you know, what gets called misidentification. But even the name of it, you know, it's a very neutral word, misidentification. Certainly when it's raised, the response given by police is that it's a mistake, it's an error of practice that occurs within the sort of complex dynamics of family violence or high-risk and crisis situations. But actually what data tells us, so what we're hearing in this report very much mirrors what specialist services and, of course, survivors themselves are saying, which is that it's not a mistake. It's actually the product of bias and discriminatory policing. It is racial targeting in particular by another name. And so that really shows up in the data about who it is who is being misidentified by police. And we know that it's overwhelmingly Aboriginal women, it's overwhelmingly migrant and refugee women. And so we're actually talking about police targeting or targeted policing. And some of the findings in this study really add practitioner data to what we have already heard and the picture that we're already building. And practitioners in the study repeatedly describe their efforts to correct wrongful identification by police. And really disturbingly, often what they describe is bringing the family violence context to police, and rather than having the, you know, what gets called a mistake corrected, actually police are then doubling down. They're often laying criminal charges. You know, so this idea that there's a mistake of practice that will be simply and easily corrected if accurate information is provided is certainly not what comes through in the stories from practitioners.
Wow. Yeah, it's really powerful that you've been able to put this report together and provide, you know, concrete evidence that police responses to family violence are not working at all, especially, as you said, when the Victoria Police are sort of holding their own data and also sort of really failing to hold themselves to account when so-called mistakes do happen, or, you know, really harmful acts that are intentional because of the bias inherent in the Victoria Police. So as someone who has obviously both co-authored this report, and you're also the coordinator of the Beyond Survivor project. You are, of course, on the front lines of family violence, and seeing, you know, the harm created by the police and their lack of accountability when they do harm people. Maybe, Lauren, you'd like to talk about what a community-led response to family violence would look like?
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, in this report, we've made a suite of recommendations, and they, without going into detail about all of those in this, they sort of broadly fall into two categories. You know, the first set of recommendations, they're really orientated at action to expose the harm that is occurring in the course of family violence policing, and action to constrain that harm. And they include recommendations like abolishing police self-investigations. They include changes such as requiring police to publicly report on the data that they already hold about police-perpetrated family violence. So that's like the numbers of officers who were reported, the actions taken, the outcomes, and things like mandatory weapons removal from any officer who's reported for family violence. So these really foundational actions to attempt to both measure and constrain the harm, but then more importantly, given the scale and the depth of the harm, we're really calling for a fundamental rethink of the role of police in the family violence system. So this evidence absolutely, you know, it builds on a lot of what the community already knows, but it dismantles the idea that police could be considered a site of safety in terms of responses to family violence. So accordingly, we're calling for resources to frontline family violence services who are already doing the daily work of responding to family violence, and specifically to services and projects supporting survivors harmed in the course of family violence policing. But then we've recommended in the direction that you're talking about, which is calling for work to build and strengthen community-based support pathways as an alternative to police responses to family violence. And we're really specifically calling for the establishment of an alternative first responder pilot through Victoria to actually start building on what happens often informally in the community, in family violence services, is in operation in other locations around the continent and internationally, to really look at, well, what are the options to have a specialist community-led response that operates entirely separately from police, and that means it offers a pathway that is, you know, absolutely independent and doesn't involve Victoria Police for survivors who are experiencing family violence.
So would that mean that it would be just like a member of community who takes part in this training and then sort of, yeah.
Yeah, so because this piece of work, even to gather the data, was an enormous piece of work, we haven't preempted all of the detail about what a community response pilot would look like. What we've recommended is basically a series of principles around how it could work and how it could be established. And so we're calling for more work to look into, well, what are the models overseas? And we've looked at things like the CAHOOTS Ambulance First Responder Service in Oregon, which uses a partnership of community-based mental health social workers and community-trained paramedics, and they attend mental health call-outs in a way that doesn't involve police, and that leads to a kind of non-violent resolution. And what it's meant is that people are not being harmed in the course of police responses to mental health call-outs. Obviously, there's been quite a lot of pressure coming from community advocates around the harm that's occurring in the course of mental health call-outs as well. So we're calling for similar work in the context of gender-based violence to really look at, well, what could a model look like for Victoria, and what would a pilot look like? And that would absolutely need to be established based on, you know, survival-led thinking, community-based thinking, involving specialist workers, and really building a pilot that then is evaluated, and we consider from there, well, what could that look like, and can it be rolled out beyond a pilot area?
Well, hopefully that momentum continues, in the push towards, a world where family violence is responded to adequately. Lauren, we've only got a few moments left of the interview, unfortunately, but maybe you would like to close the interview by just talking about how listeners can support the great work and extremely urgent work that both Flat Out and the Beyond Survivor Project are doing.
Thank you. I was just thinking about, well, what's the most important thing to say? I mean, it's a community resource now, the research, so it's available online at the Flat Out website. Please, if you are working in this area, absolutely get in touch with us. We're really keen to remain in contact. We've heard from numerous people since publishing the research last week. We're certainly also really involved in our own work to respond to violence in the community, both in a Flat Out context and in a community-based context. So we're really keen to kind of keep collaborating and to build this work going forwards, and especially to uplift all of the phenomenal local work that is happening to respond to family violence, you know, without relying on carceral pathways. And so please get in touch about any of that work and let's keep building the momentum together.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Lauren. And yeah, really... thank you so much for compiling that report as well.
Thank you, and thanks so much for this time. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. That was Lauren Caulfield, who is a part of the coordinator of the Beyond Survival Project out of Flat Out, and has also co-authored the report by the project talking about the widespread damage caused by Victoria Police's responses to family violence. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR 855 AM. Stay tuned.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. Reach out today for guidance and support. Visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you're currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think... Oh, bondage! Up yours! One, two, three, four!
Bye-bye.
That was Oh Bondage Up Yours by X-Ray Specs. Now we're going to be joined by Jess Morrison. Good morning.
Good morning, Hannah and Rob. Before I say anything else about me, I just want to say thank you to you two and your other teammates for doing the Monday morning show. It is a solid commitment to get up every Monday and be across all the stuff. So thank you for your work.
Thank you. Would you like to reintroduce yourself and tell me a bit about the campaign you're running calling for accountability in Australia's military trade?
For sure. So I work with the Australian Quakers, and I'm a Quaker myself. And so Quakers are a small church with a Christian background but are more universalist these days. They're kind of what were called like the historic peace churches, the churches who kind of see peace and pacifism as fundamental to a Christian faith. And so they have been really staunch about not just being pacifists themselves but opposing war. In fact, all the early Quakers ended up in jail for refusing to serve in the Empire's wars. So it's a really solid part of their identity that war is bad, killing people is bad because there's good in everybody. And so as part of that, Quakers have got really involved in and stayed involved in lots of peace and justice movements. They're also passionate about simplicity and integrity and equality. So I've been involved in queer rights campaigns and refugee rights campaigns and stuff. So anyway, a year ago they had a little bit of money and they said, Jess, can you do some work with us to advocate for peace? And we kind of looked around, you know, like how many things could we do with that money? And I'm not full-time by any stretch. So we knew there was an issue with the transparency in arms trade because the government was doing this ridiculous dodging and weaving about what we were selling to Israel. So we started looking into that one a bit more and found out that it's not just like the Australian public that doesn't know what's going on, not the Parliament knows what's going on, nor even the Department of Defence who issues the permits for defence exports. So the right-wing hawks were saying that the Australian Office of National, the Australian National Order Office was saying all these things. And they were saying the system's at best opaque and at worst negligently poor, that Australia sits at the lowest end of the disclosure spectrum and we need a political shift to actually have some proper disclosure so we can know what we're selling and then we can test whether Australia is actually complying with international law. So we've gone and done some work and chat about that in a bit. The short version is that we're calling for a parliamentary inquiry into this and we've got 51 organisations signed up to it already. And would love for other community groups to sign up, join the Australian Council for Trade Unions, for Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, Transparency International, lots of faith groups, including the National Council of Churches, a number of great Muslim groups, the Jewish Council of Australia, Hindus for Human Rights, and lots of great community groups like the Australia Palestine Advocacy Network. Anyway, 51 groups would love for other community groups to sign on to say we need to do better at actually being transparent and accountable with which military goods they're selling overseas.
Yeah. That was really good. Little transparency in military trade, having no detailed knowledge by even the parliament is really concerning.
So, I mean, we've watched this debate, like, for example, on Israel, right?
Yeah.
So the government's got a line that they continue to quote, like the only specific sentence they say about the exports to Israel is Australia hasn't exported weapons or ammunition to Israel in the last 5 years.
Mm.
And so there's been this ridiculous dance play out in Senate estimate for like 2 years now, or not quite 2 years, like 18 months now, about, well, what are we actually selling? And the easy bit would have been for the government to say what's happening, but instead somebody goes, oh, here's a press release from Bisalloy saying they've just got a contract with the Australian government for steel plating for armoured tanks. And, oh, here's something that says, you know, Lockheed Martin says every F-35 has a part made in Australia. Well, F-35s are being used in Gaza. And it kind of got on and on and on until, like, a couple of weeks in Parliament, the Foreign Minister said what I think is going to become an infamous quote when asked about direct exports to Israel of F-35 parts, which was new. It had come up in some great media reports done by some folks, that actually there was a flight record that showed that F-35 parts were going directly on aeroplanes from here to Tel Aviv. Yeah. That the Foreign Minister said, well, yes, we are part of supply chains, but we only send non-lethal parts. It's like, oh, my goodness, non-lethal parts of a fighter jet. Like, I think she will rue the day that she said those words because, you know, the sort of hair-splitting that's been going on is ridiculous. And it would seem, you know, I'm no politician, but it would seem like there were much better ways to have a conversation about what Australia is actually exporting to Israel than this kind of cat-and-mouse game we've had for over a year.
Yeah. What other works behind the scenes have you been doing to help push for transparency in the arms trade?
Yeah, like, so we've been working with, like, who else is concerned about this? And clearly the people who negotiated the arms trade treaty itself have got a skin in the game. And so there's people in politics who are really passionate about the arms trade treaty, and in fact Australia was, like, really involved in the arms trade treaty. Because it's obvious that if you don't have transparency in where weapons are being sold, then all sorts of dodgy things happen. And in fact, it's estimated 40% of global corruption is in the military industry. And horrific things happen with diversion of militaries as well as governments who are allowed to, you know, commit genocide horrifically as now. So we've been talking to politicians, but I've also got to chat with this dude, very unlikely kind of connection, who was the Australian ambassador to Geneva when the arms trade treaty was trying to get off the ground. And he actually chaired the final negotiations to get us there, to get us to have an arms trade treaty. Now, the arms trade treaty is in a bit of trouble now because people aren't taking their obligations seriously enough. It's not just Australia. So Peter Walcott, you know, went on to become the Public Service Commissioner and worked for Malcolm Turnbull. He is also wanting to talk about this because he negotiated the arms trade treaty. So actually when the Quakers are launching their report in Canberra in a couple of weeks, which is also online, so folks could join us online, Peter Walcott and I are going to talk about the arms trade treaty and what Australia's obligations are in terms of our reporting with what we're actually selling and importing, for that matter.
Yeah, like
the other side of the equation.
With the lack of transparency, how can people know whether Australia is facilitating, like, human rights abuses?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think we've got enough. My opinion is that we've got enough information now to be clear that Australia is in gross breach of the arms trade treaty. You know, selling stuff directly to Israel during a genocide is exactly what the arms trade treaty was supposed to stop. So we do have enough information about Israel. But, you know, it's not just Israel that's a problem. Like, we've been exporting to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who are both on selling to Sudan, where there's actual UN embargoes for arms. And we've been selling them for years, even when lots of other countries had stopped supplying them weapons because of the horrors that were happening in Yemen. So right now, Israel's genocide has to be front of mind, and it's an issue that's much bigger than what we're selling to Israel. So absolutely it's a problem, and it has been. And so in other countries which have higher levels of disclosure, then the public's able to have this debate and in some cases go to court and challenge their government, such as what's happening in Holland at the moment, because they are also sending, oh, they were sending F-35 parts directly to Israel. Their courts have now said, no, that's clearly in breach of international law and you can't do it. And then they're debating whether in the courts whether you can send weapons indirectly to Israel via the US with the supply chains. But yeah, we can't know. We can't know, and that's a big problem. And in fact, it's a problem for the government because the government signed up to this treaty, and because the Department of Defence, on one hand, issues a permit, and on the other hand, like exporters are self-reporting what's actually been exported. On the other hand, actually, we don't even have a centralised system for the government to know what's being exported at the moment.
Yeah, what is the ideal pathway to prevent this from continuing to happen and to have, like transparency in what's happening?
So the Europeans do it much better, and we've got a kind of case study. Like, nobody's doing it great. And look, you know, it's a bit of an oxymoron to say people are doing trading great anyway, but that's quite perspective. Like, we've kind of accepted that we've got a military trade, even though we wish we didn't, and we'll keep fighting for the, you know, total demilitarisation of the world. But given that that's not going to happen today or tomorrow, we're recommending the model that's in the Netherlands, where once a month they put out a public spreadsheet that says exactly what they've exported, to whom, for what purpose. And then once they export stuff, they actually monitor what happens to it. Yeah. So they do actual end-use monitoring to see where actually the military exports end up. And again, I'm focusing on exports. Imports is also an issue. But so the Europeans do it much better. Ironically, the US do it much better. We had to change our legislation here in Australia to be, you know, at least up to some of where the US was, for them to sign some of the bits of the AUKUS agreement, which, again, is inherently, you know, offensive in our view. But putting all that aside, like, Australia's systems are worse than the US, worse than the UK, and so much worse than Europe, where there's public transparency, parliamentary debate, and they're actually able to, you know, have a good, proper look at it and say, do we think this is what we want to be doing as a country, exporting these sort of weapons to these sort of regimes, and what do we need to improve it? So that's what we're heading towards. We're saying the Europeans show us that it's really easy to do much better, and we could do, you know, we could do this. We could actually have proper transparency, and therefore we could have proper accountability and public debate about what is reasonable to do in terms of our defence or military kind of trade.
Yeah. How can people be involved in this campaign? Do you have any call to actions?
Yeah, so there's two things. One, if you're part of an organisation that you think might sign up to this, I would love for you to join the 51 organisations who have joined the sign-on statement for a parliamentary inquiry into this. And also we're launching our report in a couple of weeks with me and Peter Wolcott speaking, and would love for folks to come along. The Australian Institute of International Affairs is hosting it. But all the links are on the Quaker Australia website. You know, keep searching. It's not an easy place to find, but it's quakersaustralia.info/QPLC. But if you Google campaigning about the arms trade with the word Quakers in it, you should end up there. But there's a summary brief there. There's the link to sign up your organisation to the statement, and also to the link to the event, the launch event. And in a couple of days, our full report will also be up there online for folks who really want to read 40 pages about the arms trade and how we could be much better at it. So it would be great for folks to be involved. It's part of, you know, of course, it's part of challenging Australia's complicity in the genocide that Israel's committing at the moment, but it's also looking for, like, the broad, long-term solution to better transparency and accountability.
Great. I think that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for coming onto the show.
No worries. Thanks, Hannah and Rob. All the best for you, your day, and everybody listening.
Thank you. You too.
Great.
That was Jess Morrison from the Quakers. If you want to get involved and find all the information that they're reporting on, go to quakersaustralia.info/QPLC.
Hi,
Kefirs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white kefir to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to kefirs.org.au. That's kefirs.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
Your station, your voice.
Do a bit of disrupting and cause a bit of ruckus in the colony.
Always was, always will be.
Not celebrate Australia, but instead pay homage to the resistance of First Nations people against this illegal colonial occupation.
3CR, your station, your voice.
This country's black future is a fire.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio. Last week, a report released by the Commonwealth Ombudsman exposed that between 2022 and 2024, almost 1,000 people had their welfare payments unlawfully cut by the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations. The Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, or DEWR, responded to the report by thanking the Ombudsman for its insights and accepted all of its recommendations. To help us unpack the report and the recommendations, the Monday Breakfast Show is now joined by Jay Coonan of the Anti-Poverty Centre. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I know you also appeared on the Thursday Breakfast Show last week to talk about the report, but maybe you want to start with a recap of what the report said?
Yeah, for sure. So as you pointed out, the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations, or DEWR for short, found that it had unlawfully cancelled around 900 people's payments between 22 and 24. And it then approached the Ombudsman to inform it that they had cut these payments, and the Ombudsman also received a written request by the Australian Council of Social Services to investigate. So the Ombudsman investigated, you know, how this happened. And what it found is that there were a series of issues to do with what is known as the Targeted Compliance Framework, which is a semi-automated decision-making process to suspend a person's payment. So what they found is that there were faults with this Targeted Compliance Framework that led to people having their payments unlawfully cancelled, and people who... The biggest issue was that people who was in the penalty zone remained there longer than it needed to be due to tech issues. But what is really not being spoken about through this report is that the Targeted Compliance Framework is initiated by a person, namely the providers. So if you don't meet your mutual obligations, they trigger a suspension. And we know that a lot of the time, the Targeted Compliance Framework is being used wrongly by employment services providers. So the Ombudsman, through its report, said that there needed to be some changes for JUA to understand administrative law and processes, and to, you know, develop processes better to review the targeted compliance framework. Things like that, yeah.
Yeah, so obviously there's a lot to unpack from this report. But I'm curious to know about this framework. I mean, obviously people are, at least for me when I was hearing about this, you know, people are like, oh my God, this is very similar to the RoboDead scandal, right? And of course the situation is not exactly the same. But yeah, I'm curious about this framework. Maybe you can tell the listeners when it was implemented and, you know, what sort of happened between the time that RoboDebt was investigated and then this Ombudsman report found that the framework was being used wrongfully.
Yeah, so, you know, it has parallels to RoboDebt, but it's obviously different. RoboDebt was an unlawful, debt equation or income calculation method, whereas, the targeted compliance framework kind of came out of the same era. So it was part of the Abbott, Turnbull, Morrison government era. Michaela Cash oversaw the implementation of the targeted compliance framework, which started in 2018. And basically it was just used to, narrow in and create the undeserving person on payment. So what it would do is show that the majority of people are doing the right thing when it comes to Social Security, but there is this small minority who's doing the wrong thing and it's justified to cut them off. And it did this by breaking it up into three zones. You'd have the green zone, the warning zone, and the red zone. The red zone being where you get the penalties. But what we know is that through this process, the targeted compliance framework, when you're using your mutual obligations, the providers are using it appropriately because they themselves don't know the rules. So you may not, you might just show up to an appointment and you'll have your payment suspended because these providers don't know how to use them appropriately. So it might be, something as short-sighted as that, or it could be that the providers are using it to bully people, because we know that this is written through academic research and journalistic research. It shows that providers use this system if they believe somebody has a job and it's lying to them. They will book them an appointment which they know that the person can't realistically meet to try and force them in. And if they don't come in, then obviously their payment will be put on hold. So we know there's many such cases like this that is occurring. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, obviously, just for some context for listeners, mutual obligation requirements are the tasks and activities that you sort of have to do in order to get payments from Services Australia in the first place. And obviously having them speaks to the sort of backwards idea that these systems have. It's people on welfare don't have anything else going on in their lives, and they're just suddenly free to meet these mutual obligations, whenever the government says that they have to do them. It's so false.
Yeah, exactly. And the major mutual obligation is applying for jobs. And a lot of people who are on payments long-term, be it due to disability, where they live, or the fact that you just have a low income, are applying for just, upwards of 20 jobs a month without the ability to, be able to find any appropriate work or an employer who's willing to give them a shot. So, it's eventually, after applying for these 20 jobs over and over again, you're forced to do things like work for the dole or being pushed into courses just for the sake of it, where another entirely predatory industry, which, really doesn't get too much coverage through the registered training organisation, starts happening. So, yeah.
I guess in that regard, it's just sort of perpetuating poverty, right?
Yeah, well, what's happening is it's just created a giant industry for people to profit off of poverty. You've got the employment providers who are making billions of dollars a year, who donate to the Labor Party, donate to the Liberal Party, who have, you know, for example, APM, one of the biggest contract awardees out of the new upcoming Disability Employment Service, has former WA Premier Mark McGowan on its board and former WA Treasurer Ben Wyatt, both Labor, former current Labor Party members on its board. So, you know, it's a very well-connected industry who, you know, and these companies are making billions of dollars a year while people are living off of, you know, $300 a week.
Disgusting. Let's move back to talk about the report. I just wanted to ask what the recommendations are that the Ombudsman made, and if you think they're enough to bring about meaningful change for people who need income support.
Yeah, so some of the recommendations looked at the way that the Department of Employment operates and how it makes its legal processes, because, you know, it also found that, you know, some pretty boring administrative stuff, like, well, not boring because it ended in such a horror show, but just that the policy and legal teams weren't talking to one another. So, you know, just to have these kind of like connection and to do that. So everything that the Ombudsman had kind of suggested, the Department of Employment had already accepted, or it was already going through. But the more interesting thing is that the Ombudsman is looking into a second report, which is the administration of employment services by the Department of Employment Workplace Relations. So this one is going to be the much bigger one, which will look at how, you know, how it checks, how the department checks on employment services and whether it's doing it appropriately, which we know it's not. We know that these, you know, the targeted compliance framework is being used wrongfully and it's leading to unlawful suspensions. But that's the thing that the department is defending in saying that, well, no, we believe that suspensions need to remain in place. We know that suspensions are being used wrongfully. So at the moment, one of the recommendations was to make sure that cancellations aren't turned back on until the Secretary of Dewar is confident and knows that, you know, it won't be doing it, cancelling a payment unlawfully. But before it even gets there, it's still a very rocky road. Like, we know that payment suspensions aren't happening lawfully, but they're still currently happening. So what we hope out of the next Commonwealth Ombudsman report, which, you know, later this year, hopefully, will show that, you know, providers aren't being managed appropriately and that these payments are being suspended unlawfully.
And it sounds like a huge effort for people who, you know, have their payments cancelled for whatever reason, you know, like if someone from the department decides that, you know, they're doing something, they're using this framework wrong, as you said, and then, you know, they have to go through all of these channels to eventually get to the secretary of the department in order to get their payment that really isn't enough to survive in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the process is intentionally designed to isolate, irritate and annoy people to the point where they just go, you know what, stuff it. I don't want to be on this payment anymore. It's not worth it. And, you know, there are many such cases. Many people we've spoken to, we've heard from, have been like, you know what, I just can't deal with the bullying and harassment from my provider anymore, particularly when they live in a regional area and they don't have the option to move to a different one, which may be less worth. So they're just like, you know what, I'll just go without the payment. I can just, like, wait for a few months. And that's the intention. You know, the purpose of a system is what it does, right? And the targeted compliance framework was designed to make it easier for the bullying and harassment to be streamlined, to push people off of payments, not to get the wrong people, the wrong people, to do the right thing.
Yeah. just out of curiosity, what does, like, how does the bullying and harassment sort of play out? Like, what does that look like?
Yeah, so as mentioned before, the biggest one is calling people in with short notice when they know they can't make it. In my own provider, I've been subjected to standover tactics from management, trying to force me to do things that I know that I, you know, don't have to do. It could be forcing people into work for the dole is one of the biggest things, which they like to use, where they believe that somebody isn't, you know, is working but is probably being paid cash or something like that. So it could be used like that. Or, for example, they just simply don't know the rules. They might be trying to force, an older person who is exempt from work for the dole into it, and they just have no idea that this person doesn't have to be doing work for the dole. And, you know, unfortunately, there are cases because a lot of people who are in employment services who are obviously living in poverty, quite vulnerable, and unfortunately, this is a predatorial ground as well. So, you know, that is obviously on the more extreme end of the scale, but there are cases that we have heard about and that we know about existing in this industry. So, you know, it's an absolute dumpster fire, and it just needs to be immediately shut down and all of these companies investigated, as well as the government.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge... it's a huge flaw, you know, intentional or not, in the system. In just between those 2 years, you know, it's almost 1,000 people who've had their welfare payments unlawfully cut, and that's 2 years alone. You mentioned on the Thursday breakfast show last week that the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations has been, in your words, sort of kicking the can down the road and in avoiding admission of how large the scale of this mistake, I don't know if you want to call it a mistake, is. Do you think the report and its recommendations will, are leading to a place of accountability?
I don't think so. At this stage, I think that the Department of Employment is going to try and just do everything that it's told, and pretend like the system is being fixed and it's not as big as it is. Because I think once, you know, things start to get cracked open, you know, it's going to be a much, much bigger drama. So I think it's proactively just trying to keep things low for the time being so it can just have some plausible deniability about the true scale of the problem. But for people who, you know, are researching this for years, knows the true extent of the scale. So obvious, you know, what we're talking about with this current Ombudsman report is about a select few cases from 22 to 24, but we know obviously that the targeted compliance framework has been operating since 2018. And there's another section in the Act which researchers believe hasn't been operated lawfully either. And if that's the case, it could be hundreds of thousands. And then if you look at payment suspensions, then since 2018, it gets into the millions. So the true extent of the issue here is much, much larger than the Department of Employment is letting on. And we know that this is just the tip of the iceberg. So as time passes, more things are going to start occurring, and this is going to be a much, much bigger scale than what currently exists under the current Commonwealth Ombudsman report. And I think the government is also trying to, whether willfully or ignorantly ignoring this issue is the issue. But, you know, it's going to prove to be a much, much, much bigger issue than they realise.
Mm. And I do think that the reporting on things like this, you know, last week I did, we did an interview about the unlawful cancellation of payments as well. And, yeah, I think the reporting, the way that journalists approach this sort of perpetuates the problem that you're speaking about. You know, like, we only really, not we, but like other journalists only ever really speak to the department or Centrelink or the Ombudsman himself. There's not much of platforming voices of people who are actually, you know, in this system and are actually affected by it day in, day out, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, to be honest, obviously there's a whole big issue around media literacy when it comes to social security. They're quick to point out, you know, dole bludges, or they're quick to point out, you know, the, people on payments because of the cost of living crisis and political malfeasance or whatever. But they're not, they don't really know about how complex these systems are that people are using every day. And quite frankly, it doesn't seem, it seems that they don't really care until there is something big and dramatic about it that comes out. You know, to be fair, that over the years there has been journalists who have taken a great issue, particularly from The Guardian and occasionally from the ABC, about how these systems are used, who's using these systems. But, you know, obviously at the moment, you know, it's just one ombudsman report and there is some minor interest. So, you know, hopefully over the coming weeks, they begin after this ombudsman report and the next one, there's going to be a growing interest to, you know, truly begin to apply pressure to the government, because at the end of the day, they're operating under the cover of darkness by this. And yeah, the media kind of works in concert with that because they're just mostly putting out their media releases.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's a really good note to end on. Thank you so much, Jay, for joining us. And keep up with the good work that you and the Anti-Poverty Centre are doing.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. That was Jay Coonan from the Anti-Poverty Centre. And we were speaking about the Commonwealth Ombudsman report released last week that exposed the almost 1,000 people who've had their welfare payments unlawfully cut by the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations between 2022 and 2024.
Questions, questions, questions flooding into the mind of the concerned young person today.
It's nearly Science Week again, so you better be getting your teams ready for the annual Lost in Science Trivia for 2025.
Yes, Monday the 11th of August, starting at 6 at the Birmingham Hotel in Fitzroy, Melbourne.
All the details on the 3CR website or on the Lost in Science Facebook page.
And if you want to register for a table, email us at lostinsci@gmail.com.
This deal really accentuates and is very complementary to the White Australia domestic policy. Here you have not only a white alliance, but an Anglo-Saxon alliance of the ultimate cultural allies of the United States banding together, and the significance that it is aimed at colored peoples, at Asian peoples, at Pacific peoples. This is injecting a horrible racial dimension to this conflict. So I think the US and Australian elites' racist military policies are complementing the increasingly racist domestic policies. So I think, therefore, we really have to look out very, very carefully at this very dangerous synergy between racism on the military front and racism on the domestic front.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music, and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
You're ready to make a difference? My name is Nelson Mashney. I host Palestine Remembered each Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. It's Australia's only dedicated radio show on Palestine. 3CR Community Radio is more than just a station. It's a platform for voices you won't hear anywhere else. And we need you. 3CR is an outlet that gives a voice to the voiceless. For nearly five decades, 3CR has amplified the struggles, stories, and successes of marginalized and silenced communities. From First Nation voices to workers' rights and grassroots campaigns to global solidarity, this is where justice speaks. When you subscribe to 3CR, you're not just tuning in, you're taking a stand. You're supporting independent media that fights for truth, diversity, and equality. 3CR is powered by people like you. No ads, no corporate control, just raw, real radio created by the community for the community. So what are you waiting for? Show your solidarity today. Subscribe to 3CR and help us keep the airways free for voices that matter.
Well, that's all we have time for on the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR. Before that, we heard from Jay Coonan of the Anti-Poverty Centre talking about the release by Commonwealth Ombudsman that exposed 1,000 people that had their welfare payments unlawfully cut. Before that, we heard from Jess Morrison from the Quakers about her campaign calling for accountability in Australia's military trade. And then we heard...
Sorry, we heard from Lauren Caulfield, who is the co-author of a report by the Beyond Survivor Project talking about Victorian police's responses to family violence. And the show began by speaking with Violet Coco, friend of the show, about the upcoming rally happening tomorrow to protect protesters' rights. That's happening tomorrow at Parliament House from 5:30 p.m. And with that, brings us to the end of the show. So we will see you next week. Stay tuned for Women on the Line.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.